Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Beginning of a new show, Coffee's On. I'm Ruth Ann, and with me is my other host, Tim. Hi, Tim.
Tim Nolan.
Tim Nolan.
Hi, Ruth Ann.
So, we just have been getting plenty of, what is it? There's so much going wrong in the world, and we both report on it all the time. And so we wanted to show that while we will talk about some of that, but we wanted to have more of an upbeat kind of show and pass around some of the good news, right?
Right.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Have
my cough drop.
A cough drop. Oh, my goodness. I have to admit that I'm having tea today instead of coffee. But,
okay.
You know.
Yeah, so well, I have my tea. We have, today will be tea for two.
Here we go. So I'm actually going to plug Gwen Holdenberry's Daughters of Isis because I'm drinking some of the Dragon's Blood tea. Daughters of Isis. And she also has our sister station here on Blog Talk Radio called Here Be Monsters. So, you know, look it up, grab some tea, grab some of her essential oils. It's all good. And this is not a paid commercial. thought I should throw that in.
Yeah.
Today we were going to ask each other questions and talk about ourselves. So, you know, we're introducing ourselves. Like, you and I know each other somewhat, but we're going to talk about things we may not know or that our listeners may not know. So, I don't know. Tim, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Are you ready? How did you first get involved in, what do we want to call it? Because we're both very much involved in, like, the spiritual movement and the political movement. I guess we call it life. But when did you first feel that you had a mission to educate?
You know, that's a good question. It goes back to, I think, everything happens for a reason. There are no accidents. When I was injured in football, and then I transferred to another school, so hopefully I would be able to play hockey because I know of the football injury. But anyway, I wrote a paper, The Brain and Its Functions, and this was an accelerated English class at a public school. And the teacher said, Tim, she said, in all my years of teaching, I've never read such an interesting story. And it just, I was opening up. And I was always put down, I guess, because of my, I found out I've been tested. I am a bright and intelligent individual. But then also, as I go along with the journey, my goal was to be a neurosurgeon. And I was in pre-med at the U. And I had friends that were kind of goof-offs that wanted me to pledge for a fraternity. I did not really need that social life. I was going to be focused on pre-med, be a pretty heavy duty. But anyway, moving ahead there, I survived a near-fatal car accident. I was out of body. And I had that's when I realized that was probably the start of my spiritual journey. And I was outside of myself. I was watching like in an amphitheater. And I could hear the doctor, we're losing him. And that must have been the time they did the tracheotomy. And I could feel myself actually slipping back into my body. And then moving along, I found out in doing some meditation that I met a Zen Buddhist in Arizona. And he led us in a certain type of meditation. And that also awakened a part of my brain. And it's just that, and I was just, all of a sudden there was just something that was coming out of me. It was a spirit that I had a kind of a presence I wasn't even really aware of. I never got some of those positive affirmations. And it's just the journey, doing outreach for the hospital, being on radio, TV, in this newspaper. It was just something that, looking back, that was the beginning of a healing journey for myself. And that was back in the 80s. And then having another, you know, it's just, you know, and then coming up with my thumbnail, my sense of direction is life is a journey, not a destination. And it's just, and making aware that with those affirmations, part of that journey, there's certain obstacles or challenges or opportunities that will confront us, and we can either make us or break us. We can slip into that pity pot or just feeling the poor me, and that all that does is just, we are spinning our wheels. We're just kind of in a mud deal. But at this learning to, and that's how I evolved recently. Probably last couple of years of my mother before she died was the most incredible, challenging, frustrating, the whole gamut of the piano of emotions. But I was able to share with her what I had gone through and what it was like to be out of body, my concept of the hereafter and the transference of energy and so on, and why my father was the way he was. And then, and it was just, I came up with like the four-leaf clover, and I made her a pact that she started doing. I started doing some writing. I took the pen and started doing grief work for my wife on the anniversary of her death. And that was that's a spiritual.
So you're saying that probably when you started like helping others with it. When you came back from your out-of-body experience, did you start talking to people about that?
No, because it did something, and I don't know how it happened. I was contacted by a producer for a show that they were doing on people who had out-of-body experience. And that was just something. Now, the word got around. You know, I talked to different people, but it was just incredible. And after the show, the producer said that her research, we were in the green room, the four of us, and we're like lifelong friends. We picked up the conversation and was just such an immediate rapport and camaraderie and so on. And I think that's people that do a meditating and get in touch with that force or that energy, whatever people want to define it, we will be drawn to like-minded people. That's the harmonic conversion. And it's just so many wow moments that come on today. In talking to a woman just before the show, I heard her say wow five different times.
I think we're drawing people, and it's not always, I mean, hopefully it's for the betterment of all, but you look around you and you see people who are drawn to others like them because mm-hmm. they're on the same vibration, and they may not be on a very high vibration, and yeah, that's judgmental, but I mean, they're you tell about people by their actions, and so mm-hmm. if you have people who are more in the criminal line, and they're drawn to the criminals, and
yep.
it's about the vibrations that you send out, and you meld with others of the same frequency. So when you're doing more spiritual things, You're bound to meet other people. It's just, it's synchronicity, but it has to happen. There's no way you can stop it because you're on a certain level. And I find that very interesting. And like I said, you just started talking with these people immediately because your vibrations recognized each other and you knew you had some of the similar experiences.
Mm-hmm. That was a really true soulmate. You hear that expression in the New Age and so on. I found my soulmate. And
well, there's
just,
so many
just,
soulmates. I mean, we have thousands in the world. So, I always get tickled and frustrated when I hear somebody thinking about a soulmate. Like there's one person in this whole world that is their romantic soulmate.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, people. Even before I was into Polly, I realize that you can love more than one person at a time, and mm-hmm. to restrict yourself to there's one person in this world, it's like, oh please, so soulmates, they are people who come from the same cluster.
Yep.
And there's so many of them, and in one lifetime you're not going to meet them all. It's impossible.
No, really.
But you're going to meet.
I think there's a connecting, like there's that harmonic conversion.
Mm-hmm.
Example of that was when we had Mark Johnson's Peace Through Music. we had them at the Shaughnessy in St. Paul. The house was packed. And
now,
I looked around the demographics.
Tim,
yeah,
this
St.
is Paul,
St. Paul, Shaughnessy in St. Paul, right.
Minnesota,
and,
U.S.
And
yeah.
That was, he had an idea. He recorded, asked the guy permission to record the song, Roger Dudley, about Stand By Me, and that thing actually went viral. It's over 60-some million views on YouTube. And he was at the Ordway, the largest crowd ever. And that was something that I had set a dance for. And to see, be an observer on that particular occasion, to see the families down there with their children and the harmony and the blues and the jazz that they were playing, that's another shared experience. You walk away really fulfilled.
Well, it was a high for you. Did you
high, yeah.
Tim, the song was Stand By Me?
Stand By Me, yeah. People can go
to
YouTube.
Is that that old country song?
Yeah, I think it was a Tex Ritter or one of the old country stars.
It was in the movie, maybe, that John Travolta was in, that was a country movie.
Okay.
I think. If it's the Stand By Me, and I only know one that I'm thinking of,
yeah.
But I remember the hearing, it's been a while since I've heard it, but that song that the, what did they, it was called We Are the World, and it was
That was neat, too. That's Michael Jackson was a choreographer for
that.
That was powerful, really. I had that on my blog, Global Peace, and then all of a sudden, Sony Entertainment demanded that I take it down, that they had the rights to that song. And I talked to Oprah Winfrey because it was a good friend of Oprah Winfrey's, what's his name, that was part of that. And then he worked with Oprah on doing another comparable one with the movie people were in that production for the fundraising for Haiti.
There have been some different ones. Actually, after that, they've never been quite as, I think, exciting. Or, you know, the first is often the best of a lot of things, whether it's a movie or a book or something. But there has been a lot of aid things using a lot of famous people, which is cool. They
yeah,
get attention
really.
That way. So
you get some instant validation.
But I wanted to get back to education or when you're interested in sharing your experiences.
That
was the tipping point?
When I was in 1970, I was injured on the ambulance, and I had my I was in traction and did all the procedures. I was introduced to Demerol. It was almost a little over 10 years and a month after since I was introduced to Demerol and I had that near-fatal car accident. And then I talked to the neurologist who was part of the team, and he recommended I go back to Northwestern Hospital if they had a station unit. And I went there, and I had a medically supervised detox, and I was a part of that deal for 28 days. But I got introduced to kind of the 12-step philosophy, and there was an important part of that deal. I came out of a dysfunctional family. They didn't have family week, and if they did, would they have shown up? But I asked Phil Hansen. He was kind of like a mentor. He became like a very dear friend. And he said, Tim, I give you set it up the way you want it, and that took off. Here I was in the back at the Northwestern there in one of the classrooms and getting these families together and what conflicts I had trying to mend with my parents and stuff. It just all... I realized I had been a teacher and then did outreach when I was at the funeral home, did outreach with churches and schools. And that was just, it was a natural gift for me. And it just, that ties into our spirituality. Like the Buddha, when you're ready to learn, the teacher will appear. And I did outreach.
It's
just so true.
A lot of people use, well, that's true. But that's only half of the story, really, because you also have to have an open enough mind to realize that, because many times the teacher may appear, and if you're not open, you'll miss it.
Yep.
Because the teacher comes in many forms, whether it's a book that, you know, falls on your head, or jumps out at you or something, or a person. So you still have to be open, because sometimes the teacher doesn't hit you over the head. Sometimes it's much more subtle. But I guess in many cases, because that means that you are ready, so if you're ready, you're more inclined to be open.
Mm-hmm.
Would you find that true? So that when the teacher
does... Yeah, that's
does
true, because there's some people
where,
that... And I learned that, learning how to read people and body language and stuff. And, you know, I'm only responsible for the effort, not the outcome. And it's just something that's the, or the attraction. Some people, you know, I really would take a rejection really strong. I have a good crowd. Like one time was an example. It had to be at least 300 people there. Somebody got up and left, and I lost my train of thought. I wondered, what did I do to offend them? You know, the people pleasing. And
right.
That was just part of the journey. Was just as I looked, it's so fresh in my mind now because that was a learning lesson.
Right. Well, that's it. Sometimes the lessons are the things that are, at the time are more uncomfortable, but mm-hmm. we remember that. Well, what you're talking about is totally non-attachment. It's you send out, you do whatever you need to do. You send it out. How it's received is totally out of your hands. We just, and that's very hard. That's hard to do because, I mean, we have causes and we want to get other people on the same cause, on the same bandwagon. And so it's hard. And there's nothing wrong with wanting that, but, you know, that's not our function. We don't have to worry about it. We just put it out there. And non-attachment. I know when I was, years ago, much younger, and was first, when I say Buddhism saved my sanity, and probably more than once, but at least once I know it did. But I just wasn't grasping the non-attachment because I kept thinking more in material terms. And until I learned that wasn't what it was about at all. I mean, of course that's it, and we should never let ourselves become bogged down in material things. But it also means not be attached to ideas and people, things like that. You know, do what you do. You live your life and put whatever it is out there. And some people will take it in, others won't. And, you know, that's on them then.
Yeah,
because,
really.
Yeah, you've done what you were supposed to or what you wanted, however. Tim, do you have any companion animals? You and I talk frequently, but I've never asked you.
Some we know that because I've had them in the past, and that's one thing that's really upsetting that you cannot have pets where I'm living. And it was so cute when the kids, when we had a cat, they were all so upset. Cinder would come up, and I'd hear her purring on my pillow every night because she was just drawn to me. And she, the kids are too rambunctious, but she liked the calm tranquility that I had. It was really kind of neat. We had horses and ponies, and I had a lot of different. Mom made a confession before she died, a deathbed that she gave our dog away, our little Cocker Spaniel. Because she was just such a neat freak. She didn't want to pets or germs. And
Oh, that's terrible. That's,
it was neat to break away from that and be able to be your own person.
that's really terrible. I think that, there's a lot of parents that do it like that. And they, just like the people who think that their house shouldn't, you know, it's not kid-friendly or animal-friendly. Mm-hmm. They're so sterile about everything. They're missing a great deal of life, I think, because I think digging in the dirt and messing around with the animals and all, it's a great thrill. It's fun.
Oh,
and,
really?
You know, it reemphasizes your connection.
Mm-hmm.
So the sterile life was never for me personally, but
no.
I've always had pets, and I've had them from, you know, snakes and guinea pigs to rabbits and cats and dogs and a few other things along the line, but I seem to always have cats. The felines I have. I miss not having a dog now, but one of my furs would just absolutely kill any dog that comes near. And he's never been around a dog with me, but he was like maybe 6 to 8 weeks when I was given him, and he'd been found in an alley by a trash can. So I don't know what he had gone through. mm-hmm. you know, in his very, very, very baby weeks. But, and you know, with a dog, you need to walk him at least 3 times a day. And
yep.
when I travel, it's like I don't always go someplace I can take the dog. And, I mean, yeah, I could have somebody come in and do that all the time. But I do have somebody that usually stays with the cat or checks on them a lot. So it's different, though, than to ask somebody to, you know, come on a schedule and take the dog out for a half hour 3 times a day. so mm-hmm. I guess right now that's not in the cards for me. When, and I say when.
I used to pet sit for my daughter, and that was neat, and she said you know, she was so appreciative, and I was the handyman and all that stuff. And things have really changed drastically since up to the time when before Mom died and Ryan was little and all that.
Well, I was going to say that I do hope one of these days to be able to have a dog. Actually, I want some pygmy goats. When and anybody who's listening, please get in touch with me. I really am looking for an eco-village. There's a lot of them, but I need to be in one that's a vegan one. So, because I would like to have pygmy goats and maybe a dog or so. You know, because when you're in a village like that, if you do go traveling for a few days, there's always somebody who will help out because it's a community. So, I'm looking at everybody. In the meantime, I'm quite happy where I am. I've got the best apartment I've ever had, and just love it. I'd love to move it somewhere else, but it'll do where it is. I have the top of a 2-flat, and because it's the second floor, I don't really have to worry that much about curtains. I mean, I like a lot of light. I'd like to live in a house without windows, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The curtains are necessary in the winter, really, because the house isn't insulated. So, you know. Because
I'm on the 3rd floor, and I look out my window, I can see the hybrids. It's neat at night, you can see the lights, but I can see the Mississippi River. I'm on the 1st bluff, and that's the next, right down below me, and over a little ways is the river. And I was just, the garden is gorgeous. Really.
Well, you see the lights on the river, and that's so nice. Here I just, you know, I've got windows on all 4 sides, and I have tree limbs and branches and all. So it's just lovely. That's nice. But I know my brother in Chicago is on the 20th floor, and he can look out and see the lake, and that's very cool. We can see everything from that balcony. It's on the west and the south, the window, the walls. And then you can see fireworks because in the other direction you can see the park that used to be called White Sox. I don't even know what they call it now. Every time they make a home run, they set off fireworks. So that's fun, too.
It was on the 4th of July when I first moved in. Across the river is Harriet Park, and they always have fireworks. And it was just one of those wow moments. Yeah, in St. Paul, yeah.
But when you say across the river, then that's Minneapolis?
It is going upstream, it is. But at this point, the high bridge connects St. Paul with West St. Paul.
Ah, okay.
But Harriet Island, it is an island that's surrounded by water, but it's neat. The wow moment seeing the fireworks was on the front page of the Pioneer Press the next morning.
Yes. Well, I love fireworks. I used to be, when I was still a believer in government lies, the 4th mm-hmm. of July used to be big for me. And now it just sort of leaves a bad taste in my mouth, but
yep.
the fireworks I love. My baby sister in Tunisia sent me, it's like a 17-minute video of the fireworks on the Mediterranean. Oh, my God.
Oh,
gorgeous, gorgeous. So it's like, okay, I can look at that when I get depressed mm-hmm. about things here. But I do love fireworks. And you being able to see them on the other side of the river, so there again, the river is reflecting them.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, I love them. I love them. I love them. Maybe that's coming from one of my Chinese lifetimes, the whole fireworks.
And that's, you know, that's a good point you're bringing up, that child. We all have a child within, you know, and that's just something, like I said, I'm so many friends that by 73, I finally figured out what I want to be when I grow up, a child. Because I was childish, or, you know, I had defiant, and I had a childish temper and all that kind of stuff. But now I'm childlike. I just that wow moment, just being infatuated by what, just watching. I watched them build a nest about a year or so ago, and watching the spider. Hello, spiders. What? The spiders have a function. Leave them alone.
Oh, definitely. Oh yeah, where are you?
So that's
work?
All those the people
for,
that. Yeah, really, if they're so neat freak outside, what's so dirty inside? You know, inside their own being, I think. You know, I don't want to be really sound really analytical, but I'm quick to judge, but I'm throwing darts at people. I'm quick to observe, and it's just something, well, I don't know, maybe sometime. But then there's ones that, boy, now there's something there. Like this young guy that called me today, and I taught the, I saw him in the crowd at the rally. And I partnered with him right away and mentored him and all that. And it's just neat. And giving him compliments, he almost, when I talked and he was coming back, like he didn't have that special need voice in him.
Well,
and
we
somewhere
were
along the
animal thing, though, the like you're talking about spiders and things. I mean, I know that a lot of people don't, you know, the way they can see the world best is if they have a child with them, because you see through
mm-hmm.
the child's eyes.
Yep.
And that's, but it's what the child self, the younger self is what Starhawk calls it, the younger self, that
mm-hmm.
we all need to really get in touch with and recognize. And you've talked to me before about just laughing, pure laughter, you know?
Yep, so healthy.
I just read recently that the average little child, and this was maybe a three-year-old, I think, laughs, get this, 400 times a day. And the average adult laughs four. Now, can you imagine? I mean, there's a laughing yoga. I mean, laughing yogi, sorry. That I've seen, he has a YouTube thing. And it's just so funny because, you know, laughter is contagious.
Yep.
And that's
was
what,
that
and
the
I'm
one
sure
that's
that,
ho-ho or he-he, ho-ho?
Maybe. It's, yeah. And, you know, with your work with people who are, well, terminally, maybe not all terminally ill, like ill, and you know that they say it's a good thing just if there's some kind of sitcoms a person likes or something, anybody, when you're not feeling well, watch those old, some reruns of some really, back when they had funny sitcoms, that kind
mm-hmm.
of thing, you know, and don't be afraid to laugh out loud. I don't have TVs, but I or watch something on YouTube sometimes that would just make me laugh. It's so funny because then my friends come up and they look at me and, you know, it's like they want to know what's so funny kind of thing. But I know a lot of people laugh out loud if they're by themselves. Have you heard that?
Yeah, really. You know, and it's just like when you'll cry by alone and by yourself. And those tears of joy at weddings and funerals are the ones crying at a wedding, like saying that there's something, there is a joining together, there's a harmony there, and they kind of feeling sorry for themselves, how they missed that part of their life. Is this, you know, when I started going in the area of psychology, I was getting so analytical, I had to pull back, because that was just everybody I had psyched out to look at them. I used to love to ride the bus, I had everybody figured out where they're coming from. The driver hates his job.
I've heard that there's nothing as bad as like a first or second year student in psychology, because
really?
I studied it too, but I try not to do that, at least out loud. But yeah, because it seems like that, you know, they don't know the intricacies, but they're just going by, you know, just what they see, and they don't know jack. But it's, yeah, you try to start figuring out people. It's like, okay, that's scary. At least, you know, you don't have any authority while you're doing that. It's got to learn.
That brings up a point, too, about on the spiritual journey and studying the indigenous culture and so on. Never judge a person till you've walked at least two moons in their moccasins, and that just gives more clarity.
Well, that's an old old, yeah, American saying. And it's really true, because you really don't know. You only know what you maybe see or what somebody tells you. But there's always more. Even people that we feel are fairly shallow compared to some others, and they are pretty shallow, I think, some, but they still, there's still more going on under there. Mm-hmm. And we can't know.
No.
And like psychology and psychiatry, those are, they're not precise sciences either, because you find a lot. I mean, they're not to tell people what to do. They're to try to get it out of a person, you know, what would be best. But this is not a precise thing. Our minds are so wonderful, and they're engineered to be that way, but it can be frustrating too. It can be frustrating for us, at least I think, for our trying to figure out ourselves sometimes, much less other people. But yeah, when you grow in what? Wisdom, we'll just say wisdom, hopefully, you start to know more about yourself. And the more you know about yourself, the more you know about the world. The more you know about the world, the more you know about yourself, because of interconnection. So I know you're a great one to think. I mean, you know, you never get through learning. It's and just the more you learn, I know you're like me, the more you learn, the more you know there's so much more to learn. And it's like it keeps going off in all directions then.
Alex, the word comes to mind, the humbling, you know, when it's just realizing, you know, hey, I'm not the big shot, or you deflate your ego, and then realizing the humbling experience, being part of humanity. And finding the joy in everyone. And everybody has listened, and that's learning the art of listening, that I ran across the symbols, the eyes, the ears, and the heart in Chinese. It's art of listening is ting. And boy, I posture myself and engage myself to listen and to watch and observe and all that. It's another part of the spiritually enhancing one's being.
Well, that's part of it. It's like any kind of conversation. It doesn't mean doing all the talking. It means, you know, listening and responding, which a lot of us aren't taught how to do. So there's so many things. A friend of mine talks about what she wishes that kids were taught in high school as far as communicating with each other, just like with each other as friends and with their family. And prospective romantic interests and things, because she said, you know, they aren't taught to communicate. And so when they hit all these rough spots and all, they don't know what to do. They just blow up and or just walk away or whatever, rather than sitting down and talking about it. And this is something I personally have found just wonderful in the polyamory communities, because people who do have two or more lovers are very good. They've learned they have to be very good communicators. They talk a lot, because otherwise it won't work. And, you know, I mean, like the first rule is you have to be honest. So there's just so much communication among people, and they're really good. And that doesn't mean that there's no problems. But they talk about it. They talk. It's so important. And being Gemini, I've always been into communications that way. And I just love it when I be around people who actually talk about something that matters, you know? Rather than, I mean, I can be just as shallow as anybody else for short periods of time. And it's not, you know, I mean, if you talk about your interest, and if antiques are your interest, then that's very cool. It would just not be my whole life thing. But we need to have different interests and things we can talk about with other people. That's great. I mean, with anybody that you meet. But then, like talking earlier about meeting people who have the same vibrations, and you just say, well, yeah, you can say something and you're pretty sure that it's something that they've experienced, or they're going to talk about something and you know exactly what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So, That's a whole new kind of different kind of communication.
Because it's neat, because like with radio now, I had my eyes open, but now I have my eyes closed. And the hearing just really enhances. I can feel, mm-hmm. I guess the word, I can feel what you're saying has a vibration to it. And that's
that's a friend of mine who does radio, and she says she doesn't want to do like the YouTube videos or anything. I mean, unless it is just with pictures, because mm-hmm. she wants to be able to concentrate on interviews, yep. To listen to the people. She doesn't want to bother about looking. She wants mm-hmm. to listen. And I totally understand that. I know where she's coming from. Tim, what about you would we be really surprised to find out?
Mm-hmm. What a softy I guess I am. You know, I've worked at and I describe myself. Somebody else asked me that same question one time. I said, I'm a gentle man. And she was kind of taken back. She actually just kind of went back a couple steps. You know.
Really?
She processed that. She said, oh, you know, that's right. The first time we met, you were concerned about getting my car wouldn't start, and then you wanted me to call. And I said, yes, you really truly are a people person, and you really truly care that you go that extra way, and that this and it's such a society.
Why would somebody be surprised to find that out, though?
I guess because you know she was she worked for the post office, and she. Worked at the airport and running the tug and all that. She was just kind of a really in a macho role. You know, it just blew her away there is a few of us around. And I guess I'm not saying that being facetious or egotistical. That's what I've evolved in that because I was able to fine-tune after I was injured on the ambulance. When I first was injured and got dropped out of school, and I worked in the ambulance and went to mortuary school in Dallas, and I was around death and dying, doom and gloom up until 1985. But the looking experience I learned, like a friend of mine, we worked together, and she went back to school and became an evangelical minister. And I was invited to give a talk one time at her church. And she said, Tim, tell the people again what you described, what my job was. She said, I learned more working with Tim in 1 year than I did 4 years at the college. The University of Minnesota should have given Tim my tuition. And I said, my job description was to close the eyes of the dead and to gently open the eyes of the living. And that's a skill I worked at, and I groomed that. The company allowed me to gave me that latitude.
Okay, so being sort of a pussycat at heart, that's one thing that some people evidently would be surprised to find out. What's another thing people would be surprised to find out about you?
That I really, truly care about people. And
but
I just,
no one would be surprised. Tim, people who know you would not be surprised to find that out. Yeah. I'm talking about something you've done or seen or something that, you know, just might surprise people. Just a fact out of your life. I'll give you one for me. Most people that know me, people that know me closely know, but a lot of people don't know that for several years I helped raise my partner's children. Okay. So I was a stepmama figure for several years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was then, and it was just something that I learned a lot from. But I know people are surprised when they do hear that. I'm trying to think anything else that somebody might be surprised about me. No, it's a lot of things that they probably wouldn't because I'm pretty outspoken and people know what I really like. I lived all around this country for, several years, actually. I traveled a lot and got different perspectives on things. So I really believe that the saying about, travel really, really helps you grow.
Mm, definitely so, yep.
Yeah, because I know you've lived around several places. And, you know, mm-hmm. some people, it's not, a friend of mine is dead now, but he had never really traveled much until his later years. He had actually spent his whole life on the east side of the Mississippi. until a few years before he died, he made a trip out to the West Coast. But yet he was very, very well-educated because, I mean, he educated himself about different places and people and situations. But, you know, I haven't found a lot of people like that who haven't traveled and still know that, because a lot of people are much more provincial.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's people in Illinois who've never been to Chicago, and to me that just seems like blasphemy.
That's the whole thing.
Because I love Chicago. And what's even worse is they don't want to go. They're many of them are afraid for, yeah. You know, and so they don't have a perspective of what it's really like. They've never been there. They're afraid of it. They don't want to go. They just hear about, you know, some murders or something, and they think that's the whole city.
Yeah, the
so
whole
I know
city,
you
yeah.
run into that, because even though St. Paul and Minneapolis are, well, they're the twin cities, and they're pretty large, but still, you've lived in other places that weren't quite that large, and you know what? People do have some very preconceived ideas.
Oh, definitely so. It's just like, because I like the harmony that I saw when I was living in Boulder, and I love the mountains, but I never would want to live in the mountains. That, to me, is too isolating. Some people like that isolation. My kid brother is that way. He's Vietnam, post-traumatic, yada, yada, yada. He does not, being in the family, he was the lost child, literally. He's got lots of critters. He's got his own pet cemetery in his backyard for all his critters.
Yeah. Living in the mountains, yeah, I could do that. I mean, as much as I want to move maybe to a warmer place, I loved it when I lived out west. And I lived in Idaho, Wyoming, and Oregon. And I love the mountains. There's something about
Oregon
that.
Oregon seems like such a mellow state. It's just neat. The people I know that live in Oregon is something.
I live in the in Milwaukee, which is like a burg of whatchamacallit? Can't say it. What? Portland. And then I also
Portland. Okay.
I also lived in the Oregon Desert, which a lot of people don't know exists.
It's the first time I heard that.
The eastern part, it's a desert. You've got your like sagebrush thingies roaming around, and there's quite a space there. And it's not sand exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's dirt. Nothing's growing there except maybe some sagebrush for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles and miles. And it's very beautiful. It's flat, but it's beautiful in its own way. But I learned a long time ago, I think the first time I was crossing Montana, was it the first time? I don't know. That not Montana, Wyoming. That some people don't like, if they're not comfortable with themselves, they don't like all that open space. And they don't like the mountains and that kind of thing because they're not comfortable with themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And you know,
you're just
you're
the flatlanders, yeah.
Yeah, well, if you're out, I grew up in Illinois, and there's an awful lot of flat. But I'm talking about where you can go for miles and miles and miles and not see anything. Any mm-hmm. building, any human except whoever's with you, that kind of thing. And people get nuts. Just like people in a cabin, they talk about people going cabin crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's because there again, they're not around other people. And I wouldn't want to do that for months on end necessarily, but I do. I love being by myself.
And this one thing I liked about my travels was in Arizona, the different terrain, the climate. I love the Red Rocks of Sedona. That was just such a spiritual. And I connect with a lot of New Age people. We want the bell, not the bell, what they call it, but it was just the harmonic conversion and so on. That was some of the fun. And then the desert was so healing. I met Bryce. He was a retired firefighter, and I had been a volunteer firefighter. And he gave me a ride out in the desert in his dune or his jeep, and that's when I saw these charro, the bristly cacti, and there they were, a little silk crown of flowers on the top, and again, that was in April, because they take on all that water and they hold so many gallons of water and all that. That was neat.
Hey, people think that there's no life in the desert, and Well, I know that sometimes you just have tiny little plants, but you also have tiny little animals and bugs and things. And the desert's alive.
Very much, yeah.
But what's taught about that? You know, it's amazing the things that we aren't taught. I've only been through, or I should say across Arizona in my different travels, but I've spent a little time more in New Mexico, and I really, really, really loved it. Last time I left New Mexico going east, I remember there was a double rainbow. And it was wonderful because I was just crying and crying and crying just to be leaving. I really, really loved that state.
That's when I met another Buddhist. I was working with a population in just north of northwest of Albuquerque, in that terrain up there was so neat. I could go down in the valley there, and I could walk by, and the Buddhists, they were there. People were saying they'd sleep on boards and all that, but it was just a harmony. That's all you could hear is. I heard an echo on that one.
I should ask you, how much meditating do you do?
It's just I do it on a pretty much on a daily basis, but to actually sit in my rocking chair with my earphones on, I do that about once every maybe 10 days. I get a little frazzled, but I want to get back now and discipline myself to do that, starting out the day, because the morning time is my most creative time. And I'm getting a membership to the Y, and I got a special rate on the deal, and I'm going to get back and get my muscles in tune and toned and all that good stuff.
Yeah. Well, all of that.
Getting back with people are surprised when they find out how old I am. Oh, come on. No, you're not that old. You all look a day over 40, 45.
It's not really, I think it's not honoring whoever we want to say. We can say God, we can say Creator, we can say Prime Being, Supreme Being, whatever, it's not honoring this entity or ourselves when we do not take care of our bodies.
Yep,
and,
really.
I'm always just disappointed, and there again, I mean, I shouldn't even be attached to the idea, but I am always disappointed when I see people who proclaim to be so spiritual, and yet they take no care of their body.
Mm-hmm.
They eat total junk. They're 100 pounds overweight. They barely, you know, waddle from this to that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's really...
and it's like, well, you know, you're not honoring yourself at all.
No.
I'm not saying that you have to work out and, you know, be Mr. Super Muscle Man of the Year or something. But, and the women, I mean, just go walking. Just eat something that's good for you. You know, they just don't honor, and they, oh, well, I'm so much in my head, I'm so spiritual, and it's like, well...
Yeah, that's... Yeah, hello.
Well,
I don't want to get on that party line.
No. It's like, okay. I mean, it's sort of sad that... I mean, yeah, because you don't. You say, well, so what's wrong? All you people standing around are, like, overweight and... not breathing well, and, you know, have all these aches and pains and complaints all the time, but you're on this major spiritual path. It's just sort of hard to, for me anyway, to comprehend. But maybe it's just because I'm so much into the connection between everything on the planet and ourselves. I think that's it.
Yep, and that's when I kind of lost my edge, is when I got so informed about the universal, the global stuff. And I was doing aquatic therapy at the Shalom which is primarily a Jewish, and boy, I just was very open about my opinions and all that stuff, and I was told not to come back.
Oh! Not,
seriously, isn't that something? So but then I figured out, well, you know, I like that aquatic therapy, and the Y downtown St. Paul does have a pool, and I can get back to that. And I was doing aquatic therapy at Regions, and the therapist told me about it. She said, but it's Jewish. And I just thought that, and I said, my God, you know, I just didn't realize, but I'm not going to change. Because I found out, I talked to a guy that, he said, boy, you learned the hard way. He said, I just picked up right away that a lot of these people are so opinionated. He said, I just go there and do my exercise and get the hell out of there. But I was in the water, and I felt very a camaraderie and talking and all. But I laughed out, but it pissed me off.
Well,
to have some young guy running the thing to tell me not to come back.
Well, discernment is something we all have to work on, which means, like, you just don't blurt out everything to everybody.
No.
Unfortunately, but that's what it's about. You sort of pick your audience, sometimes,
really.
Like, truly, you don't care because you have a message you want to get out,
mm-hmm.
but when you're someplace that you want to be, like your friend, he says he just goes and he does it, and sure, he's nice to everybody, but he doesn't bring up anything that's going to, you know, make waves, so to speak.
Oh.
Cool.
And I was so confident with Global Peace and giving out my cards, and was very, the way I have it designed about the Pentagon propaganda in the Middle East and all that stuff, so I was putting it out there. I have no regrets. But everything happens for a reason. This will be a better setting and all that, be more upbeat.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've known a lot of people, there's none around where I personally am, but who, in fact, a friend of mine works at a Y, and she loves it. The people I know go to the Y, who join or just go in occasionally, whatever, really do like it. And, you know, I think it's great. And it's one of the places that's much more reasonable financially than some of the gyms. Now, some of the gyms actually, depending, like for boxers and all, they're pretty reasonable because that's all they do. I mean, they don't have a lot of other things. But the Y has the pool, but it has a weight room, doesn't it?
Yeah, it has weight rooms, it has treadmill, and has all that stuff. And I'm not going to become a health freak. Because I was a jock, and I had a well-defined body. I think that's why I was able to be so resilient on this trauma my body went through. And I never once lifted a weight, but my body was well-defined just by doing light exercise and walking around Lake Harriet every single day, a 40-minute walk.
Oh, no, definitely. One of my friends is in probably Chiang Mai now in Thailand. No, he's in the Philippines now. Who he only does body weight exercises, Jeff Sigrick, and his body looks like a power lifter. And
oh boy!
he's very, very healthy. He's vegan. That's been for like 20 some years. He does a lot of, like, he'll do 900 squats, okay? I mean,
talk about it. Usually he does it.
he does a lot. He's like a health coach too, but he doesn't use any kind of equipment or machinery. And he also runs, he says, you know, if you want to use those things, that's fine, but it's totally unnecessary. And like you were saying, I mean, you were in other things, so you don't have to have a bunch of equipment as such.
No,
I mean,
no.
The equipment's fun, okay? Sometimes it's fun. Mm-hmm. Just like ritual, you know, Wiccan rituals and some other pagan rituals, you don't have to have all these tools at all. None are required. But sometimes it's just fun, and it's a focus. So, you know, just like in the kitchen, you're a cook, I know, and, you know... There's fun gizmos that you can have in the kitchen. There's fun electronics. I mean, you know, appliances and things
the juicer
that you
and
can
all.
Have. But you don't need them. You know, you can be an excellent cook. And you think about, like, parents and grandparents and all. I mean, those women, they were strong. They whipped up those angel food cakes by hand, okay?
Yeah, really?
And they carried great big pots by hand. So we don't need all those appliances and things. It's nice to have, but you know, if it's if the acquisition of those is going to give you a few more years where you have to work three jobs to pay for them, like, come on, think, people, you don't need all this bullshit. You know, think for yourself. You don't have to fall into this consumerism.
No.
But there again, that's, you know, people who feel disempowered. They have no power, so they're just going to watch TV and believe commercials.
And flip on the power switch for their juicer. That just sounds very aggressive, very violent. Throw everything in the juicer.
Yeah, they do. And depending on what
takes
the
spirit right out of the veggies and the fruit.
Now, the juicers and blenders, and I mean, I've got them. I don't really use them. I personally like to eat my fruit and vegetables rather than drink them. But I will. I like carrot juice. I like some of the juices. But if, you know, it's one of those things, you want to use everything. If you use a juicer, if you have a juicer that leaves pulp behind, you need to throw that pulp in your soup. I mean, you can compost it at the last resort. And our time is almost up. I wanted to mention this Saturday, as most Saturdays, there is the Global Brain Project weekly worldwide meditation event. I will post that on Aramark Theo Facebook page, because this is a great thing that David and Ingrid have started a long time ago. And, you know, it's like wherever you are in the world, it's a planetary thing. So I really suggest that people do that, because we're trying to, you know, like your page is global peace and all this. We're trying to strive for global peace. So I think anything that is pointing us in that direction is a good thing.
Right.
So do you have any final words here, Tim?
It's fun because, like, people who are listening to podcasts, as I found the experience today, close your eyes and then you'll be able to take in and you listen and you can allow yourself to start visualizing what you're hearing and so on. And that is such, and that's why I love the intimacy of radio. I was very young, 7 years old, when TV was introduced to our neighborhood and all that stuff. But I'm looking forward to Ruth Ann and I talking and getting to know more about each other, our likes and dislikes and preferences. If you like what you're hearing, spread the word and join in our conversation. And the advantage of podcasts at your convenience is really a super feature.
That is really nice, but people don't have to be up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and listening. I did pretend we're going to talk about Earth Day. We really didn't. We will be from time to time, though, because we will be talking about the environment and the good things that people are doing for it. So it's exciting. I mean, I keep reading that people are really doing things for the animals and for the planet. So it's all good. We're going to get better acquainted, and please let us know if there's any topic that you want us to talk about. We're just going to try to keep things on the uplift for this hour. I like that word.
Really fun, uplifting.
Yeah. So I will be seeing you next Thursday, same time.
Next Thursday, same time. All right. Next Wednesday, I should have you a guest on Angel of Mercy.
Ah, okay.
Do a brief intro,
Yeah. Okay. I will say good night. Good evening. Good afternoon, Tim.
Yeah, good afternoon. Guten Morgen, Fräulein. To our German listeners.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
fan either.
You're on.
I'm here.
James is here. I guess I'm the only one who's on the con, not here. I have a really good excuse. I'm fighting a really terrible cold, so I'm my brain is fuzzy, well, more than normal. Welcome to Five Rivers Radio Hour. I'm your host, Michael Gorman, and we have a guest tonight whose name is James L. Bianchi. James is a San Francisco Bay Area lawyer. He's a druid with the Order of Bards, Hermits, and Druids, the founder of the Taliesin Grove, founder of the House of Danu, which is a Western California druid network. And, well, let's just say that when I was trying to print James's resume off, my printer ran out of paper. So, James, welcome to Five Rivers Radio Hour.
Hi, Michael.
So, it's amazing looking at the breadth of the stuff you've done. You not only are a very active lawyer in the Bay Area, you are an activist for kids' issues, and you're very much a part of both the pagan community in the Bay Area, the Druid community, and the interfaith community. So, anyway, give us a little bit of your history, how you came to be a high-power lawyer and a high-power druid at the same time.
I guess it had to do with when I was 20, attending San Francisco State. Became a draft counselor. This was during the Vietnam War.
Can you talk just a little bit louder, James?
I was trained as a draft counselor during the Vietnam War, and we opened up a counseling center at San Francisco State called the Demilitarized Zone. And
nice.
We managed to get about 15,000 people out. I eventually had a staff of 10 counselors. The students were very generous in their funding. And we set up counseling centers throughout the state and also made sure it was available in outside the college community because there was an economic draft going in. I mean, those who were attending college had a deferment. Those who were not got drafted. And so thereafter, I was just trying to make sure I didn't peak at the age of 20. always became, I don't know if I've quite made it, but it stirred my involvement in a variety of things. And then,
so would you say that
I was raised a Catholic and got over it by the time I was 17, and always felt that I was in the service of the goddess, whoever she may be. And I was in a bar with my best friend who mentioned that he was a druid. He was also an Episcopal elder at St. Paul's in Benicia. And the two concepts overlap quite well. And
Benicia, for those who don't know, is a small, really wonderful town in the Bay Area, the east side of the Bay. Big arts community, great place. Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. And so he suggested I go online with the order, and I started reading the materials and went, duh, it just seems so obvious. And finally, I had a religious belief that brought synchronicity to my life because it incorporated all my values in so many other areas, particularly in how to live well in a way that doesn't damage the earth. And druid lifestyle leads you in that direction automatically, and you evolve to a point where every act becomes a sacred act, even recycling and how you do your dishes and how you acquire your food and how you travel becomes a sacred act in your relationship with the earth. And that's very comforting. Plus, we don't do guilt and humiliation, which saves a lot of trouble. Plus, there's in druidry, there's no devil, there's no hell. That also saves a great deal of trouble. And we could just focus on doing the right thing just because it's the right thing, not because we face punishment, you know, by some overwhelming God.
I was talking to somebody just recently about how linear our culture tends to be in its thinking, and when you think history in a linear sense, well, the line's got to begin somewhere, it's got to end somewhere, so it almost dictates that you have to have some sort of final resolution. So, you know, heaven and hell are kind of necessary for the linear way of thinking, whereas pagan thinking tends to be a little bit more cyclical than linear.
Mm-hmm.
So,
no, that's not to say that karma isn't a bitch from time to time.
Yeah, exactly. We just pay for it on an ongoing basis instead of just a big shot at the end. So, yeah, some of the organizations that you've been through, I know I met you for the first time when we both participated in the first Druid ritual that was presented at Pantheacon, the big West Coast pagan conference, and it just seems like you've been kind of around the corner everywhere in the pagan community ever since then. Was that fairly close to the beginning of your Druid path, or had you been on it for a while by that time?
I think it's within 5 years. I started,
yeah.
I think, in 2000.
So,
we've been doing Pantheacon for well over 10 years. And Rodney Carr was presiding before that.
One of the things that I love about your life, your resume, the things that you've been doing, is you tend to mix and match things that people don't usually put together. I mean, you're a lawyer, you're a druid, you're a performer, you've worked with some street theater, you've worked with a spiral dance, you teach at Cherry Hill Cemetery. I knew I was going to say that. Why is it seminary? It's my Catholic fear coming back. So hard to pronounce. Do you ever have people go, you know, look at you as sort of like deer in the headlights look when you talk about all the stuff that you do?
Well, I don't talk about all the stuff that I do. Once it's done, I'm looking for what I should be involved in right now. You know, what are the new challenges before me? What is it there out there I can fix or make better? And from time to time, I completely fall on my butt doing so. Or spend an enormous amount of time on things that just don't go anywhere. So I keep on trying, because sometimes they do.
Well, you know, one of the good things, but also one of the frustrating things in life is we tend to learn our best and most lasting lessons by our screw ups. You know, kind of makes the lesson stick.
Success is not possible without failure. Donald Trump's declared bankruptcy 4 times.
So, when in your practice as a lawyer, is there ever much crossover between that and your interfaith work, your work in the pagan community? I know there's probably crossover in some of your youth advocacy work, but how does that work for you, balancing those two things?
Well, there are a couple crossovers. One is chaplaincy program that I'm working on with the prisons. Our order has asked that I respond to correspondence that they receive in Sussex from inmates in U.S. prisons because they really don't know how to address the issues in the United States that the prisoners
right.
are confronting. So I've been doing that for a couple years and have a pretty good idea of what's going on throughout the country and parts of Canada in the prison system. And, of course, the other way it helps is I set up nonprofit organizations within the pagan community, such as the House of Dana or the Fire Tribes, and being a lawyer helps in doing
yeah, that. Yeah, yeah. I've gone through that application process for nonprofit, and it's it's not an easy thing for us civilians to get. So you work in a prison ministry. Are you ever visiting the prisons, or is yours mostly through correspondence? I know that you have several friends, colleagues in the Bay Area that also work in chaplaincy.
Those who correspond can't really visit. And so I'm focusing on correspondence and setting up mechanisms to train prison visitors. Because they do need this contact. The situation with California prisons is a big mystery to most of the public. They're in a state of crisis. They're under a court order to eliminate overpopulation. We have well over 150,000 people incarcerated, and it's estimated that up to a third of them are reaching out to pagan traditions. They don't necessarily go in as pagans, but they're attracted to our traditions because we're non-judgmental and very accepting. And it focuses on personal spiritual development and not banding together so you can hate people that are different. And,
right.
And that's just plus, you know, most of the inmates are Christians, and it didn't help them that much. And so they're looking for some alternative. And the Pew Survey, National Survey, shows that those who are incarcerated who embrace a religious belief and follow it have a far lower recidivism rate. And it doesn't matter which religion they embrace, as long as they embrace something.
Right.
That sort of sets them aside from normal gang culture that exists within our prison system. So anything that we can do to encourage their embracing any kind of religious belief is ultimately not only beneficial to them, but beneficial to us, because most of these people are being released at some point. And if we pounded all civilized behavior out of them and made sure they couldn't get a job and have very poor skills, we're creating problems for ourselves.
Right.
And already have.
Yeah, sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. They'll end up back in prison. Well, yeah, if you don't provide them some way to integrate back into the culture. One of the things I'm very proud of in our Celtic tradition is that reintegration was the expected outcome of any kind of justice action, that it was not about, you know, punishing with a bigger and bigger hammer, but finding out a way to take this person and weave them back into the culture, because, you know, we can't afford to waste a human life and human talent. So are there programs for pagan inmates when they get out?
No, there are not, and so this is why the Pagan Alliance has absorbed the chaplaincy program that's administered by the Druids of the House of Danu, and we've set up a management site that's restricted to those who actually correspond with inmates or who are chaplain volunteers for the purpose of bringing in other traditions and making them aware that there are people of their tradition who are incarcerated and need contact, need to connect with the pagan communities outside, so they have some place to go or people to contact to assist in the reintegration. And pagan, or most communities are slow to respond to this kind of need. It frightens them. They figure, well, they're in jail for a reason, and, you know, my life is already complicated. I don't need this. But we have to step back and look at what we've done in our criminal justice system. We have over 2 million people incarcerated. That's the highest number in any civilization in the world. Now, it's not that our people are more evil than those in other countries.
Just really, really bad folks.
It's that our system is quick to demonize, punish, and engage in retribution. There were various pushes throughout the past two centuries for rehabilitation and reintegration, but then you'd have people on the other side who were, Christians who were more bent on falling over themselves to see who could be more vicious to prisoners.
And it doesn't work. It never worked. That's a drag.
Oh, it never did work.
You get harder and harder punishment.
And then we have to look at what is this population that we're so afraid of. Now, probably 40% are there because they use substances. There, but for the grace of the goddess, many of them.
Right.
And these are things that are not crimes in many other societies. And so we should. A lot of judges are doing drug courts and trying to find alternative ways to do this because they know just locking them up is nuts, particularly if they're juveniles. But the tone in the country has to change. We need to have a conversation about this because of the cost of doing this, our students are in debt, hundreds of thousands of dollars just to get a BA in some cases, where before we were hysterical about confining people, in many states, upper education was free. And, we paid almost nothing for public education in California until Reagan became governor.
When I was in college, my tuition and fees for a semester were $98. That was it, $98.
Yes.
Part of that,
and that won't
really
get
old,
you to the first day in college. And
it won't get you a tax.
That's plan. Hurting us. And one source of funding so we could free our students from this burden and making sure they're properly trained for what confronts them in the future is to stop wasting so many of our resources unproductively and confining 2.5 million people, whereas we could be just as safe if we confined, 150,000 of the very worst. Because aside from, the large number that are there just for using substances, we have those who were unable to prove their innocence. Let me give you this scenario. Let's say you live in West L.A. where there are 1,000 street gangs, and you have two choices. You can join a street gang or you can die. And then let's say you're accused of a crime, you have a juvenile record, and there's a false identification from a witness. It's inaccurate. All right. You're facing 30 years in jail, and you have no resources. And unless you have the resources of OJ to prove your innocence, by the way, which is opposite of what the standard is supposed to be, you're supposed to be not guilty.
Yeah, I think the Constitution has
some
rules to prove
that. But in that situation, we have a false ID witness against you. And then you're in the hallway, you're given a deal. Okay, you can take 10 years or you can go 30 years if you go to trial. Those are your choices. Now, for a person without resources, that's a no-brainer. They'll take the 10 years, even though they did not commit the crime. And we probably have close to 15-20% of people incarcerated at enormous expense, costing more than it would cost to put them through Harvard, for crime they did not commit. And if they were not evil before they went in, we pretty much made sure that they're evil and useless by the time they get out.
I've had discussions
felony on
the
record,
this.
They can't get a job anywhere. I mean, it's nuts. It is nuts.
I've had discussions with other pagan leaders about this and the fact that, I do a lot of historic work and, tracing our basic cultural system were the grandchildren of the Roman Empire, which was very hierarchical, patriarchal, punitive. And it was those attitudes that we as pagans suffered under so much in the Middle Ages when the Roman Church was trying to consolidate its power. And yet it seems that pagans today don't understand that the compassion, rehabilitation, bringing people back into the tribe, into the fold, considering people innocent until they're proven guilty instead of the other way around. Those are essential values to our tribal ancestors. And why is it that so many pagans don't seem to know that, do you think?
Well, pagans, like anybody else, are struggling to get by on their fingernails, you know, and and many are self-absorbed. They're doing this for their own personal spirituality and bliss, and not really overwhelmingly concerned with the overall civilization and long-term planning. I mean, it's just, and that's just not pagans that suffer that. Most people do. We're in a culture where life is not fair. We're playing where the rules are set against people, where we stopped being a democracy maybe 3 decades ago in lieu of a plutocracy who has people bending over for, you know, the rich superclass. And people are struggling so hard just to get through the day, it's hard to get them to focus on things outside.
Well, you know, that's also how the Roman Empire did it. They had actual slaves.
And
we have, you know, underperforming schools and prisons to provide us with people that will take whatever shit job you'll give them and not question it and work their butts off for the rest of their lives without getting the benefit of it. It's kind of built into the system where it's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about pagans starting to learn that there's a whole other way of looking at the world that our ancestors did, and they lived fairly peacefully, sustainably on the land for way longer than this system ever did. But kind of, you know, you can always tell when you're talking to a pagan elder, particularly druids, because things come full circle. And you were talking a little bit about people coming to paganism for their own personal spirituality, which, of course, it's all about self-empowerment, but it's also about community. And we were talking about the lack of infrastructure in our community. And one of the things that I've noticed is that you try to talk about programs for senior elders, programs for pagan kids, and you get this kind of like, well, you know, we got to be in our small little groups in case the burning times comes again, and like everybody's paranoid and ready for it all to fall apart again, and so we're too afraid to come together in any kind of big way. But as somebody who's working towards social justice, how do you think you can motivate the pagan community to say, okay, there's a different way of doing this, and we need to stop pretending we're back in the Middle Ages?
Well, I think first of all they have to realize that the burning times are over. And that at least legally, you know, all those societal efforts to oppress pagans had pretty much been vanquished. And so it's time for us to come out now. And that's really what the Pagan Alliance was about, becoming visible. And much like the Buddhists did in the early 50s, the Buddhists were feared right after World War II, particularly in California, where the hatred against the Japanese was still palpable. And Christian ministers would say bad things about them because they didn't know anything about them. And so the Buddhist monks did something really bright. They started showing up at the prayer breakfasts, fully robed, and sitting down with the priests and the rabbis and the evangelical ministers, and who got to know them personally and also who got a better understanding of what Buddhism was about. And said, well, God, there's really nothing wrong with that, once they understood. It's not threatening. It's not harmful. And now the Dalai Lama is among one of the most popular guys on the planet. Because people generally don't consider Buddhism anymore. So we've started becoming visible. You know, in Modesto, pagans came out with a float during the Christmas parade, you know, and they had people dressed as goddesses. And in Berkeley, there's a pagan festival every year, and of course, we were together at the one in Stanislaus. We're trying to be visible so people know that we're not stupid, we're not evil, we don't have a devil, you know, there's really nothing to fear from us. We are just searching out a better way to live that's sustainable.
There was a show ongoing here in there was a show going on here in Sacramento for a long time called Coffee with the Clergy. And my friend Deborah Luna, a.k.a. the Witch of Loomis, got on the show once. And first of all, she's fun and bubbly and kick-ass sexy. And all of a sudden, there were these ministers, you know, that were like, wow, these people are kind of cool. And I ended up getting invited on to several times. And we would just discuss issues that various clergy were dealing with. And you would think, I mean, a lot of pagans would say, oh, there's no way I'm going to go there and hang out with a bunch of Christians and you know, be like Daniel in the lion's den. But the reality was, when you sit down and talk to these people, they're just trying to muddle through like everybody else. And they actually started enjoying the different perspectives they would get. And the best part for me was one time when this really rabid fundamentalist Christian came on. And when he found out there was a druid on the panel, he just immediately went on attack mode to me. And all the other ministers defended me. They're like, who is this guy? How dare he do this? And, you know, so it's really true for just out there. And people know us. We're pretty cool people, you know.
Yeah, a historical example is Don Frew, who used to work at the Shambhala bookstore in Berkeley and is with Covenant of the Goddess. And about 20 years ago, there was this Christian seminar on paganism and witchcraft and the devil, and he thought he'd show up to see what the minister had to say about us. And he signed up as COG, and so they thought it was a Christian person. And they listened to a couple hours of them saying all kinds of evil things and misstatements about paganism and witchcraft. And then he stood up and said, my name is Don Frew. I'm with Covenant of the Goddess, and I'm a witch. Do you have any questions? And at that moment, everything transformed because, I mean, he's not a threatening-looking person by any means. He's very well-spoken, and they immediately engaged in long conversations over coffee and munchies after the seminar, and he became deeply involved in interfaith religious organizations and, of course, the Parliament of World Religions and the interfaith group in Marin, and is very popular among other clergy of other traditions and has transformed the way they view paganism. And that's what it takes. It takes people just to show up, you know, stand up and say, here I am. Do you have any questions? And
it's
not that difficult dispelling it because, you know, the Christian ministers really don't have anything authoritative about paganism to respond with. It's all made up stuff. Or just extensions of the demonization of nature itself, and which hasn't, it really hasn't led us anywhere nice when they did so. It
right,
led to the
right.
oppression of women and the destruction of the natural order. And I think we're beginning to realize that that's not quite sustainable and we could be doing ourselves a mischief in the process. And that's an underlying anxiety I see in Christians, that there's something not quite right here. You know, so spending a lot of effort hating those who are of different traditions or, you know, demonizing nature is not sustainable, and it's really not helping us at all. It's not making themselves happy, and so they're open to other stuff. In fact, when we put on the Witch's Ball in Benicia a couple of years ago, and some Pentecostal ministers or people who act as Pentecostal ministers showed up. And they showed up because they were generally interested to learn about our culture and tradition. They were getting really tired of bad-mouthing, you know, Catholics and Jews and people who are not their form of Christian. And that just didn't sit right with them after a while. They knew that was, you know, that was not going to lead them anywhere. And definitely not closer to the one. And they were quickly embraced. I gave them drums, you know, and gave them
nice.
Some instructions.
Nothing like handing somebody a drum.
And I started seeing them at every big pagan event thereafter, you know, for a couple of years. And they just loved the community and were surprised that they were universally embraced, which is not something they'd experience even among Christians.
I had a similar experience when I did a hand fasting, the Celtic wedding ceremony up in the Sierras. And I asked the couple beforehand, are there going to be people of other traditions so I can kind of explain what we're doing? And they said, yeah, but pretty much all of our friends know that we're pagans and they get it. But then there's Grandma. She's this dyed-in-the-wool, right-wing, fundamentalist Christian, and she thinks that paganism is of the devil. And we're not. We almost didn't invite her. I said, no, bad karma not to invite Grandma to your wedding. I said, let me see what I can do. So I basically just took the oak tree as a symbol in the ritual and talked about it bringing water and earth through its roots and fire and air through it, and then creating itself and growing like gangbusters. And then when it gets to a certain stage, it starts giving back in the form of shade and habitat and fruit and nuts. And I sort of compared that to a new marriage. It grows first, and then it gives back eventually. And so I just kept using that metaphor of the oak tree because I thought trees are pretty innocuous. And Grandma came up to me afterwards, and she had this little girl look on her face that you see sometimes with very old people. And she said, I've never told anybody this before, but when I was a little girl, I had this oak tree. And whenever I was sad, I would go climb in her branches, and I would swear she was holding me and talking to me. And I just smiled at her and said, it's okay. There's a lots of us that did that. That's she was smiling and she was holding you. So I was able to go to the couple and say, it's okay, Grandma's a druid. She just didn't know it, you know. Once she was exposed to the beauty of it, it was all the walls just came tumbling down.
Well, Christians will just experience a lot in pagan ritual that they find very, very familiar. And as you know,
right.
That's because many of their major holidays incorporated the pagan holidays of the cultures where they
right.
were, as you well know. The holly and the ivy, the Christmas tree.
The church tried to plop another holiday on each of us to try to wean people off of it, and the good paganous country folk of Europe said, sure, bring it in. We'll just throw that in the mix and have an even cooler holiday. We'll do all of it. It wasn't quite what the church was shooting for.
Yeah, but it has backfired. Halloween is a good example.
Speaking of the church in the Middle Ages, one of the things that I hear a lot in the pagan community that I know you've heard of too, I'd like your take on it, is that there's a tendency to set up history as this grand battle between Christianity and paganism, and that Christians are the bad guys, pagans are the good guys, and it kind of paints all Christians with one brush. And most pagans, actually most Christians too, don't know that the dominant form of Christianity until about 1000 AD was actually Celtic Christianity, which was built on the Celtic model, you know, egalitarian, gender inclusive, you know, not the gap between the rich and the poor, all those wonderful things we love about paganism. And the Roman Church hated the Celtic Christians as much as they hated the Celtic pagans because they were not, you know, buying into the hierarchical money system of Rome and of later the Roman Church. But the irony is that aspect of us versus them, two fighting sides at all time, is something we directly inherited from that Roman system via the church. And it's a frustrating irony that you see people attempting to find another way by basically reflecting the one that they're coming from. What would you say to pagans about that and setting up this us versus them with Christians?
Oh, there's just us. And there's just the one, and there are many paths to the light, and it doesn't matter which one you follow as long as you believe it, because it's belief that gives it power. And so when the Jehovah's Witnesses or the Mormon missionaries come to my door, I greet them joyfully because I know why they're there. They're there to keep me from going to hell. They're there because they love me. And
right.
you know, rather than getting in an argument, they're going to lose a theological argument with me. You know, so I don't even start. I acknowledge the fact that I'm very, you know, pleased that they have found a path to the one that works for them and that gives them joy and comfort, and I rejoice in that. And it's just that I'm in the service of another, you know, I'm in the service of the goddess, but it's the same one. And we're just using different metaphors, you know, and it just doesn't matter.
I love that you said that we're using different metaphors.
Yeah.
We have wars over who's
battling
the right
each other
metaphor.
Over metaphors. Yeah.
Right. That's crazy.
That's something Joseph Campbell brought to light in the 80s during his lectures with Bill Moyers that I think transformed spiritual culture in this country. It was absolutely astounding because he was raised Catholic, and then he embraced Buddhism and Native American shamanic practice and understood religion for what it was and how it evolved and to what extent it matters which one you embrace, and it really doesn't as long as you believe it and act on it. I mean, we have an example right now of a Christian who actually is in Pope Francis, who's pretty much blowing us all away by his going back to really the original concept of what Jesus preached.
It does my heart good as an ex-Catholic.
This is at least three centuries.
Francis is my hero.
Oh, yeah, he's awesome. And, I mean, particularly by sort of chastising the German cardinal who spent $40 million on his palace in Munich.
Yeah.
And so he removed him. I mean, in this day and age, that's absolutely mind-boggling that a person, a grown-up, would do so, you know, and not see the little problem there. And that's not what Jesus was about ever. There is a gentler and kinder Jesus before he became captured by the big institutions and politics. I mean, there are three centuries there before he even wrote down that he was God.
Right.
Something else. That didn't show up until the third century writings. And from my perspective, it doesn't really matter because we all are to a certain extent. We're all a remnant of the One. We're all an expression of the One. And the closer we get to being sensitive to that and channeling that and doing what we should to promote species survival, which necessarily means promoting the survival of other species as well because we're intertwined.
Because it is our ecosystem.
The easier life becomes and the happier it becomes. And we shouldn't waste time, you know,
one of the things that I like to do,
it doesn't matter. As long as they believe it, if it works for them, we should rejoice and embrace them. And once they feel you doing that and feel that you don't reject them or don't hate them because they're a different belief than you are, that changes their relationship with you right away.
Right.
And you even can talk to arch-conservative, narrow-minded, you know, Christians and reach them on that level and change them because people are actually, you know, we actually are misjudging people, usually, by putting them in a box. You know, the Republican, therefore, they must be brain dead. You know, and that's wrong. It's absolutely wrong.
One of the things that I like to do with my Druidry, I have this game I play with myself. If I reach some sort of philosophic or social conundrum, I sit down and say, okay, what would the trees say about this? You know, the Druids talk about the trees being our teachers, and this whole thing about, you know, which is the right path to the One, to God, to heaven, to an oak. And I started thinking, okay, in a purely physical, rational sense, if I'm in a forest, and I need to walk in that forest to get to this village, and I'm standing east of the village, I have to walk west to get to the village. You know, so I do that, I walk west, get to the village, and hang out for a while. It's a great village. I love the village. I hope everybody finds it. And then I continue on my journey west, and I meet somebody else. If I tell them to walk west, they'll never find the village. They actually have to walk the exact opposite direction that I did in order to get the village. So telling them you get to the village by walking west doesn't make any sense because everybody's starting from a different point. It has to be different in order to get there on a purely rational sense. I'm like, you know, so we keep sending people into the ocean looking for the village, and they're wondering why we didn't give them better advice. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Of course, that speaks to our need to travel and think that things are always better someplace else. And what
right,
you forget
right.
is that if you go someplace else, you're bringing yourself with you. You know,
right.
if that's where the unpleasantness is coming from, you're bringing it with you. You know, so it doesn't matter where you go. You have to make things right where you are. You have to make things right.
You know, I met a guy after Hurricane Katrina who was here, and Sacramento was like the third town he tried. And he was just talking about how miserable he thought Sacramento was, and then he talked about the last town, and that one was miserable, and the one before that was miserable. I said, well, were you happy when you were living in New Orleans? He goes, no, New Orleans is pretty much miserable, too. I don't want to go back to that. I said, okay, what is the common denominator in all four of these towns from your perspective? It took him a while to go, me? I said, bingo. Maybe you're looking
exactly.
in the wrong place to make things better. Which is, you know, God, we have circular conversations. I love that. Which brings you back to the empowerment aspect of empirically and other paganism. It is an important element of it. It's just not, it just has to be in balance with the community as well. And we're not used to doing that kind of collective thinking. We're so used to doing either this or that. So if you were, James, as a obviously leader in the pagan community, where are you heading? Where do you think things are going? Do we have
well,
reason
I
to be
think,
hopeful?
Yes. And the Pagan Alliance has a booth at the Pride Parade and Festival in San Francisco every year. It's a major fundraiser for us. My first office was on Market Street in San Francisco, so I saw the very first parade over 30 years ago. And then I was a parade monitor last year, and there was a dramatic difference between the
you're
two.
Like old.
The first one was everyone was extreme, you know, it was 90% drag queens and gay bars doing loud floats. You know, where everybody's mostly naked and gyrating and stuff, and then just trying to be as outrageous as possible, just to scream out, hello, we are here, you know, deal with it. But last year, it was really a parade of assimilation. There were contingents from the National Guard, from the police department, from the sheriff's department, from the DA's office, the public defender's office, Safeway, Bank of America, all had huge contingents in this parade, all at Kaiser Hospital, and all the politicians of merit, you know, were in the parade, and that was saying something totally different, that we are an integral part of the culture now. You know, we have arrived, and we're doing. Yes, there are problems that still exist, but generally, enormous advances have been made. And we're doing just fine. And that's where the pagan community is leading. Initially, we had a parade starting 10 years ago where we were outrageous and, you know, wore our pointed hats and had a witch's brigade. And but now we're becoming visible in many other settings. And where people are beginning to regard it as ordinary. In Benicia, when we publicized the witch's ball, it was a very dominant Christian community. Nobody raised an objection. Nobody was concerned. And now when they put out a holiday greeting on the main street, they say, Merry Christmas, Happy Solstice, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa. They include Solstice. They know that that's the first of them all. And we're beginning to assimilate into the overculture, and our existence doesn't frighten people anymore. At least those who know us. And this is something I'm sure you've recognized in your older neighborhood in Sacramento, when I was primarily Christian, and you know, you'd have that bumper sticker that said, well, when the rapture happens, can I have your car? And they loved it. And we went wassailing. I was there when you went wassailing through the neighborhoods for Solstice, singing what sounded like Christmas carols, but they were really pagan hymns. And, you know, the Christian neighbors were there with the lawn furniture and the drinks, you know, when we, you know, hoping we'd arrive and say, oh, the pagans are coming.
Yeah, you get to the point where they would plan their Christmas parties on the solstice because they knew we'd be waffling. You know, one of my favorite moments during all of that, it was the first year we did it. And we were kind of nervous. I mean, are people going to throw stuff at us? Are they going to hate us? Are they going to think we're trying to appropriate Christianity? And it was just like people coming down the street singing and playing drums and dressed really cool. Everybody loved it. But as we're heading back to the grove, we're going down, I don't know if you remember this, but there's we're going down this one street, and this guy pops his head out of the porch, sort of tall Victorian porches with the stairs, and all of a sudden you hear, "Honey, get the camera! The pagans are coming!" Like, I want that to be my model for my life. Honey, get the camera. The pagans are coming. We actually went by that house for years, and I remember the year we went by it, and the wife was pregnant. The husband started bringing his guitar out to play with us when we'd sing at his house. And then we saw the newborn baby, and I think the last time we did it, she was about 7 or 8 years old. It was pretty amazing. But, yeah, it's like, you know, when... And our traditions are so much fun. I mean, that's why they've kept so many of them in the Christian context, because drumming and robes and candles and processing and singing and dancing and all that stuff is just fun, you know?
Yeah.
I think
if we could
really get the idea that people genuinely love this, and, you know, they may not even pay attention to the lyrics, and that's okay. You're just celebrating with your community. Speaking of,
even the Christians are attracted to those denominations where they sing hymns and they dance and they embrace and
right.
They're open and excited. They're attracted to those denominations. And so what we do is not at all foreign to them. And the Georgians are the
same place. One of the comments, I'm sure you've probably gotten this too, when I teach about Druidry, is people always come up and say, this is not so much like learning something new as remembering something I forgot, you know, because it speaks to so many of those things in people's hearts, the love of celebration and the self-empowerment and the community and all of that. Speaking of processions and performing
it
things,
feels right.
You've worked a lot with my brain just went blank, the troupe that you've played flute with, it does the Ren Fairs.
Oh, Dance Macabre.
Dance Macabre. Thank you.
Dance,
for my brain. So tell me about that. I just think that's just really cool to throw in the mix of all this other stuff that you've been doing.
That's actually an ancient Catholic tradition. The Tintenfonds that pervaded Europe during the time of the Black Death. There they thought death was an angel that flew over them and would just grab people. And so the idea was that if you dressed up like you were dead already and appeared to be having a good time, then the angel of death would pass you over thinking you were dead already. And people believed it. And so, you know, there's many ancient woodcuts and frescoes where you see people dressed as skeletons and zombies and things like that, and that's what it stems from. And when the Renaissance Fair began in Novato, the Pattersons happened upon an ancient woodcut from the 11th century showing this very concept, and they investigated it. They were historians, and they convinced local street musicians to give it a try at the Renaissance Fair, and that's how Dance Macabre emerged. And it now has two major continents, one in Northern California and one in Southern California, each of which has maybe 7 core members and maybe 30 or 40 people who join in at various festivals throughout the year. I join in 2 or 3 of them throughout the year, my favorite being Casa de Fruta in Hollister, because that's closest to the first one. It feels like you're in a real village. And it's run by the musicians and the vendors. And the other is Dia de los Muertos. In San Francisco, which is an amazing parade. Nobody's actually watching it because everybody's in it. Everyone wears black and puts on skeleton makeup and carries a candle to someone who's passed. And there are samba bands and various marching bands and dance macabre at the end. And you wind through these narrow alleys in the Mission District, which is lit up like an opera set at night, where people put altars on their front door stoops.
Remembering
grandparents and beloved relatives, which is a wonderful Catholic custom, which came from the Celtic, by the way.
Right.
And end up in a park where there are huge altars and huge puppets, and it's just, and then the galleries and restaurants stay open until very late. It's just a wonderful community experience. And so that sort of caps off my Samhain season at the end.
One of the frustrations I have is modern media, when they talk about Halloween, they've finally gotten to where they know the word Samhain, that it came from that, but they always portray Samhain as this time when all of our ancestors were cowering in fear because ghosts were coming back and we were trying to scare them all back across the veil, when in reality it was a celebration of connecting the ancestors. You know, when ghosts came back, it wasn't a bad thing for Celtic people. It was like, grandma's here. So,
in that context, a lot of people emerged in 1942 in Minneapolis, of all places, the trick or treat. You know, because they were just, kids just seized the opportunity to light stuff on fire and to trash places, thinking that spirit, and they could blame it on the spirits, you see. And so the Chamber of Commerce came up with this idea of trick or treat, that if people bribe them with candy, they'll leave their house alone. That's where it starts.
The idea for the winter solstice waffling that we used to do. It started with about five friends who were in a bar, and they say, "Well, it's winter solstice, and isn't it like a druid thing? And didn't they like burn stuff?" And they just had this drumming procession and went to somebody's house and burned something. And when I'd ask them, "So what? You guys aware of Samhain, the Day of the Dead?" No, it's just like a cool time to burn stuff.
I had this bizarre experience in the third grade in Catholic school over Halloween. The nuns were offended by the notion of Halloween, thinking it was a pagan tradition, right? So they insisted the brethren coming over, whatever costumes we wanted, that we come dressed as saints.
Oh, no.
It was like a convention of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where we appeared with various states of mayhem and torture, with eyeballs missing and arrows sticking out of our heads. It was the last time they did that. They thought, you know, Snow White and cowboys is a lot safer, you know, elementary school children.
Yeah, you want scary imagery. Go to those old states. Heads getting chopped off and all sorts of cool. So kids must have loved that. I could just see the nuns kind of looking out, going, "I don't think we thought this through."
No, it gives the concept malicious obedience a whole new meaning, you know.
how to kill a woman with kindness, as Shakespeare said. Your sister just is a saint. God, I wish I'd thought of that when I was at Catholic school. That would have been way fun.
But it did make me basically ritualistic, and that's why when we, as you know, in our order, when we get to the bardic level, we are encouraged to create our own ritual once we understand what the ritual elements are. And so the Taliesin elected to do so in the ancient language of the Celts, Scots Gaelic. Primarily because most of us grew up with Latin masses and enjoyed the power that brought using a sacred language, even though we did not know what they were saying. And it has worked very successfully.
I've had friends say, "You just became a druid because you didn't want to give up the robes and candles and incense, right?" I'm like, duh. That was all the good stuff. So, James, before I forget, we've got a little bit more time, but I want to make sure that I get this in before I forget. If people want to find out about you, about your work, about the Pagan Alliance in San Francisco, Where are some places that, that folks can go to? Are there any websites that you can give us that people can go to?
Well, there's my law website, but that's just about my law practice. Pagan Alliance has a website. It's paganalliance.org. House of Danu almost has a website that's up. There's a House of Danu Facebook page where they can send inquiries. And if they're interested in learning about Druidry of our order, they just go online and Google OBOD, O-B-O-D, which stands for the Order of Bards, Ovates, and Druids, which is in East Sussex in England. It's the largest Druid order in the world. And
you know, that's actually one actual website that I've always remembered because it's so short. It's just druidry.org. I love that.
Yeah. And it has podcasts and music, and it shows you where you can get the online written materials for studying Druidry at home if you wish, and also a way to connect with other groups in your area, because they do have a worldwide sort of network. That's
so they can tell you where specifically you could find an Obod-style grove.
Yes. And there are other Druid traditions as well. There's ADF, and which is the oldest one in the United States, which is very... They're a little different, though, in that they are religion. Obod is a magical order. It's a big distinction. Right. No, that doesn't mean we're at war with one another. We get along fine. We use pretty much the same scholars, and we party together at all our events.
I noticed that ADF Druids tend to talk about it as Druidism, which sounds like, you know, Catholicism, Protestantism, Judaism, whereas Obod says Druidry. It's like something you do, not something you, a religion. But, yeah, I know,
well,
I know what you mean.
If you embrace
we
it on that level.
We have fun together, we party together. I did have somebody ask me once what all Druids had in common, and I told them the word Druid. Because we tend to be, strong-minded, intellectual, argumentative type. I always, when I think of Druids getting together, it's kind of like the old Jewish meetings where they'd be shouting at each other across the table and wagging their fingers, and then, you know, you'll have a glass of wine together, which I love.
You know, what I always keep in mind is the concept of the one, and it is so vast and so huge. We are less than a molecule of sweat on a flea's left testicle, and to think it would be upset with us for not worshipping it properly is just inconceivable. That suggests a deity with self-esteem issues that are just incomprehensible. So there's no point in arguing that kind of
thing. I had trouble with a fundamentalist brother of mine who kept saying, are you a polytheist or are you a monotheist? I'm like, yes.
Yeah. Of course.
Can we stop talking in these dueling duality things? Like, why does it have to be only two options? You know, I prefer lots and lots of options. Briefly, in the last couple of minutes that we have, James, is there anything that we haven't talked about, some of the work that you're doing now that you want to throw out there?
The Warrior's Call. 50 years ago, a Native American shaman named Stocking prophesied.
It's like the Academy Awards, the music is coming, talk fast.
Oh, okay. He prophesied things that showed that right now we are beginning to experience the mental health effects of putting toxins into our environment. And that's what's leading to cannibalism. That's what's leading to the most horrible crimes that make absolutely no sense. And we should engage in acts of magic to counteract this trend. And
awesome.
For the first time in our history.
All being part of that, reconnecting to our own ecosystem. Looks like our time's up, James. Thank you so much for being on. We're going to have you back. I love talking to you. There's just so much to talk about.
Well,
thank you.
Fun talking to you.